Welcome back to the Sophie May Fitness podcast, guys. I'm joined by Jake today. Jake is my mentor and an incredible health professional in the industry. And I would like to introduce you to him. Jake, who are you? What do you do? Who do you work with?
Thanks, Soph. Pleasure to be here. So my name's Jake. My last name's Dolichel, which is super hard to pronounce, and I don't think anyone's ever got it right. So I like that you just skipped over it. Perfect. Perfect. Well done. Well played. So I'm a health coach, like you said, technically a nutritional therapist and a fitness coach. And so my sort of clientele, I kind of started working out in the gym or training in the gym. And I found that almost everyone I was working with seemed to have these health issues. There were just these hurdles to them achieving their goals. And so my work kind of expanded beyond that. And I started trying to dig a little bit deeper and work out, well, what's going on here? Why are these subgroup of people who were generally women, to be honest, why were they not able to actually achieve the health goals, their fitness goals? And it sort of led me down some, rabbit holes. I got really deep into blood chemistry and sort of gut health came up as part of that. And so I guess I've sort of evolved into now working exclusively with people who do have some of these health issues. And whether it's a body composition goal first and foremost, or a fitness goal first and foremost, and a health issue secondary to that, or it's a health issue first and foremost, and they want to achieve improved body composition as well, the two tend to go hand in hand. So that's kind of who I work with, what I do. And it's something that, like, I love having coaches like you on board, because as coaches these days, more and more people are dealing with these issues. 100%. And it's something we can't really ignore any longer.
You can't
so
avoid it.
I totally agree. Exactly.
And I think as well, like, for me, and I know I've spoken to a lot of other coaches in the same sort of situation, we kind of start as personal trainers. We're like, yeah, we're going to work in a gym. We're going to train these people. And then you kind of go further and you're like, okay, I'm going to coach these people. You know, to me, training is like, you know, doing a session in the gym, but coaching is kind of like an all-round sort of approach. And I kind of didn't really mean to fall into, I was quite young when I qualified as a personal trainer. You know, I was like, oh yeah, I work in a gym, awesome, train people. And then as I got further in, I was like leaning more towards, like, I have my own health issues as well. And I guess that always kind of like pushed me into the health side more. But as you go year in, another year, and then you learn from different people, you kind of realize that there is actually a lot more to the body than just, you know, cut your calories down and train four times a week, you know, you'll be good. And then you kind of come across these problems and you just learn more. Like for me, when I delved more into, like, obviously working with you, you as my mentor, blood work, gut health, I was just like, holy moly, like, this is like a complete different world. And I didn't mean to go into it, but I obviously enjoy it and I love it now. But most of us start out as personal trainers, actually probably not realizing that there is actually a lot of these issues out there. And I think that that's very, very common. It's kind of popping up more. People are kind of going, oh, you know, well, you must be lying if you're not losing weight and you're eating these calories.
Yeah.
And we've kind of coming more into people being more open-minded that there can be underlying other issues going on, not just what you eat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's something you just can't ignore anymore. You know, as a PT or a coach or someone working in the industry, sure, there'll be a subset of clients who that's not going to be an issue for, but you're going to deal with these clients at some point. And you're going to have a client who, you know, you've done everything perfect. You've dropped them down to 1200 calories. You've given them stacks of steps, 20,000 steps, whatever, and they're not losing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they're always feeling bad. You've reverse dieted them. The energy is always low, whatever it is. And when you get that client, you're going to be forced to either dig deeper or you're just not going to have the tools to actually know what to do with them.
Sure.
So, yeah, 100%. It's definitely something we need to dig into more as coaches and PTs.
100%. Like, it's so important. And one of the biggest things I've learned from you that I'm actually going to go into is that, you know, the gut health world is actually insane. Like, so interesting, so much to go through. And they say that the gut is like the second brain, right? Because it's like so much happens within the gut. So your gut health kind of is, you know, pretty bloody important for the body. But one of the main things I've learned from you is that symptoms of poor gut health aren't just, you know, bloating, indigestion, things that actually directly correlate to the gut itself.
Yeah.
What are the main, or I guess, what are the other kind of symptoms that people probably wouldn't think are actually related to their poor gut health?
Yeah, it's such like a mental shift. Like, you know, I grew up in a family where my mum was a nurse, so I was sort of surrounded by conventional medicine for quite a long time. My housemate for a long time was a nurse. And so I guess I inherited what I'd say is sort of a a common belief system where you can be lucky or unlucky with your health. And you kind of like roll a dice and it's like, okay, you kind of got this condition and that's just the way it is. Or you've got this symptom. You know, I had really bad asthma as a kid and that was just kind of the way it is. You know, you like people are going to deal with different issues and there's nothing particularly causing that, or there's nothing you need to, an imbalance that you need to address. It's just kind of the way health is, the way that person is. And it's a whole mental shift to actually get to a point where we realize, you know what, nothing works in isolation. Nothing, no outcome is coming out of just an isolated event, but actually the skin conditions you've got and the asthma you've got and the psoriasis you've got and the fatigue you've got, generally speaking, there's going to be the same. And I don't want to say that it's the same cause per se, in that I mean it's not necessarily there's going to be, you know, one parasite or one bacteria which is causing all of this, but it's the same, I guess, foundation. There's ultimately dysfunction, imbalance, whatever we want to call it. Mm-hmm. And that is the bedrock, which is causing all these other things to occur. And so often, you know, I'll get clients where they'll, you know, depending on how far along in this journey they are, they might still have this viewpoint, kind of like what you said there, where, well, gut health is just bloating, or gut health is just constipation. Mm-hmm. And they might say, I'm not bloated, or I'm not constipated, or maybe I'm not constipated that often. It's, you know, a couple times a week, but that's normal, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But I have, you know, I've got focus issues, or I've got really bad anxiety, or I've got, like, to give you an example, it's probably easy to work in examples. And this is, I had a call yesterday actually where this was someone I was speaking to where they had a lot of symptoms of a yeast overgrowth. Okay. And so there's physiological symptoms we can point to of that. So that'll be things like literally getting yeast infections, or coating on the tongue, or anus itching, vaginal itching. So these are pretty easy to point to physical symptoms. Mm-hmm. But what this person didn't realize, and a lot of people don't realize, is not only does yeast cause yeast infections, but yeast produces a toxin called acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde is the same toxin produced by alcohol. So ethanol converts into acetaldehyde. And so on blood work, it's actually going to look quite similar. If someone is a heavy drinker, or someone's got a yeast overgrowth, you're going to see fairly similar patterns. Mm-hmm. Now, what impact is acetaldehyde going to have in a system? A, it's obviously a big detox burden. So you're going to have, there's going to be some liver burden. So you're going to have low energy, because that's going to take a huge amount of your energy for your body to continuously be detoxifying this toxin. It's a priority toxin. But B, acetaldehyde actually damages a part where you produce, it's called the nigra, where you produce dopamine. Oh. And so firstly, it leads to spontaneous release of dopamine. So it's kind of this like misfiring of dopamine. Mm-hmm. And then you burn out these receptors. So now if someone's going to be more prone to things like anxiety or low motivation or low drive, yeah, or addictive personality traits. So I'm sitting in this call and this person's like, I don't know why, but my obsessive behaviors have kind of gotten worse and worse and worse over time. I'm now getting yeast infections every month. And it's like, yeah, this is all interconnected. And you know, it's easy to think, well, I just have anxiety and that's just worsened. Or I just have X and that's just worsened. But ultimately, whether it's neurological conditions, whether it's, you know, it's focus issues, you know, whether it's skin conditions, that's obviously a really common one that a lot of people don't necessarily put down to the gut. But all of these things tend to be interconnected. So when someone says to me, I guess to wrap it up, if someone says, what symptoms are caused by my gut? It's almost like, well, what symptoms do you have?
Yeah.
And those symptoms, probably, they're caused by some form of internal dysfunction or imbalance.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think that's super interesting. Like, the biggest thing for me, like, when I found out that anxiety is, I would not all the time, but obviously quite a lot of the time, is to do with your gut health, and or it can be, I was, like, mind blown, because I was like, it's just crazy how, you know, the gut is so connected to the brain and the body itself, and how sort of we look at mental health problems, I guess we could say, as direct to, oh, you know, we'll just take some medication, but we don't think, oh, it could be related to like my actual health. And I think that was such a game changer for me, because I was just like, and obviously, you know, the normal conventional way is to be like, oh, we'll just take some anxiety pills. But that's obviously just masking the probably where it's actually coming from, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, that's typically what medication does. It's not treating the root symptom or the root cause, I should say. It is simply trying to treat and assess and mask whatever that symptom is. And so, like you said, you know, is it going to make things worse, or, you know, what's going to happen in that outcome? Well, the problem is when you mask a symptom, whatever's causing it is still there. Yeah. And so in the case of, you know, when I talked about yeast, well, yeah, part of the acetaldehyde might be causing anxiety. So can we shut off that anxiety? Well, maybe we can take a medication potentially to mask that.
Yeah.
But the yeast overgrowth is probably just going to worsen. And so what's going to happen next? Well, now we're going to get, like I said, a skin condition, right? Now we might develop psoriasis or eczema, which has a huge correlation to yeast. Yeah. So it's almost like we're doing ourselves this disservice where, and I don't want to take away from relief care. You know, it's important for people to actually improve their quality of life. You know, if that's sort of the first step for that person, then wonderful. But if that's the last step for that person, something else is going to pop up eventually. Yep. If we don't address what caused that in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I've had the same thing myself, and obviously this is something you've helped me with, but I had acne for literally like 10 years. And to be honest, it's common when you're a teenager, but when you get to, like, you know, I'm in my 20s now, and it's like no one really, like, I look around and the first thing I notice about people is their skin. And I think that's just because I always have bad skin. And I find myself looking at people's skin and it's the first thing I'll notice about them, which sounds really weird. And I'll look around and I'll be like, no one else has, like, I seem to be the one that's only, that carried my bad skin all through teenage years and into my 20s. And it was something, like, it's not awful now, but it used to be really bad. And I kind of look at people and I'd be like, how is their skin so perfect? Like, why is mine so bad? Why has nothing helped my skin? And it was the same thing as what you've just said. You know, I think I was on, like, you know, 5 medications for my skin when I went to the, when I was a teenager. Obviously didn't know any different then, because you don't know, do you? You kind of just go to the doctor and think that it'll clear up. You know, creams, tablets, Roaccutane, which my mum originally didn't want me to go on. And then it was kind of like, the doctors were like, no, don't worry. Like, you know, it's last resort. We'll do the bloods. We'll get it sorted. Don't worry about it. I had skin treatments. I had light therapy. I had literally everything under the sun. Oh, maybe you need to change your pillowcase every few nights. Okay, do that. Maybe you need to wash your face after sweating. Okay, we'll do that. And nothing seemed to help. And it was kind of just like, I was always given a pill, but I was kind of like, well, why is everyone else's skin clearing with the pill, but mine's not? It's hormonal contraceptive pill as well. That was obviously offered. And I went to go get bloods and I was kind of like, oh, I just want to get some bloods to, you know, see what's going on my skin. Oh, why don't you just take the pill? It'll clear everything up. No, I want bloods for my skin. And it was just kind of like really frustrating because no one could help, like literally no one. I was given so many different medications and nothing helped my skin. And it didn't occur to me until, I'd say probably in the last 12 months, I'd say. And obviously since working with yourself, is that it's actually coming from internal, because we often go, oh, just wash your face, just change your pillowcases, don't touch your face with your dirty hands. But all of that obviously could help. But if we're not treating the inside cause, it's actually fueling it. It's actually never going to go away. And I think that was such a big game changer for me, because I was like, well, it's never going to go away unless I actually do the inner work for it to actually stop occurring altogether.
Yeah.
And I think that's a classic example of we kind of just have something for everything. It's never kind of about why it's occurring. And I think skin conditions, and obviously not just acne, but it's like eczema and psoriasis and stuff, like, I hope I said that right. Things like that are kind of related to the gut as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we almost fall into this trap sometimes where, like, I'll get clients or people contact me and be like, I've got this condition. And sometimes I'm amazed by the new condition. It's like, man, that's one I've not heard of. And I look it up and it's like, you know, this condition means they've got this symptom and this symptom. You know, they've got psoriasis and they've got, I mean, you know, whatever, just two different things combined.
Yeah.
And it's like, we fall into this trap of thinking, well, every condition is different. Every condition is caused by something different. And obviously, you know, you need to work out how to treat that exact one condition. Otherwise, there's nothing we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, no, typically all these things are just popping up because of the same thing. And like you said, you know, with this, obviously you can take a change of pillow and you can take, you know, use azelaic acid and you can use whatever and take your Accutane and maybe you'll be able to keep your skin at bay. But ultimately, whatever's caused it to get to that state, it's still there. You know, you can take PPIs, you can take antacids and that might keep your acid reflux down, but whatever's causing it in the first place, it's still there. You can use immunosuppressants that might help with the psoriasis, but whatever's caused, it's still there. Yeah. So, you know, that is, and again, we're not taking away from, you know, potentially using some of those things for a period in time if someone needs that kind of relief.
Mm-hmm.
But when it stops there, we don't end up kind of ever resolving the underlying health issue.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it was, you know, you do realize you're kind of just like, nothing's working because the actual direct problem is still there. So, you know, Roaccutane cleared my skin. My skin, oh my, like, I see photos and I'm like, oh my God, my skin was incredible. 6 months later, it was worse than it was before because that root problem wasn't actually solved. It was just...
Yeah. And that's the thing is, you know, and it's not just skin, but, you know, to give you another example where this is the same mentality, like endometriosis, right? How often will someone who's got endometriosis, and obviously it's a debilitating condition and, you know, I don't, it can be, I guess, really confronting for people with endo to hear, you know, something that worked for one person and they feel like nothing's worked for them. Yeah. And there's a lot of sort of emotion in it all. But how often do you hear of someone who, you know, they've had surgery done, and maybe that's relieved the pain for a period of time, and then 6 months later, it's more painful again. That's a story I hear every time, almost every time I have clients. I'll be like, yep, got a laparoscopy done, pain was a little bit better. I'm like, how's your pain now? Oh, it's worse than it was. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not saying that's what caused it to get worse, but it's like there's only so many, you know, sort of short-term interventions and band-aids we can use until that thing's just going to get worse again, and even worse than it was in the first place.
For sure. I agree. And I'm massive on women's health. I really, such a big passion of mine. So I'm really glad that you brought up the endometriosis side of things. It's becoming a lot more common, or more people kind of know about it, and more people are developing it as well. From what I've seen, like PCOS and endo seem to be like on the rise. And with endometriosis, I think it's a lot more, what's the word? Like it's probably a lot more complicated than we kind of sort of see it as. It's like, oh yeah, pain, we need to cut out the lesions and stuff like that. But the problem, like obviously it's not caused, we know that it's not directly caused by one specific thing, right? Like we don't really know the exact cause of it. But there are things that drive it, like that continue making it worse.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I'll just touch on a couple. So, you know, we know, again, from a study perspective, that women with endometriosis have higher levels of lipopolysaccharides, a toxin, in their blood, in the menstrual blood. And so LPS, that toxin, that's produced by negative gram bacteria. Mm-hmm. So we can deduce, therefore, that women with endo, not every single individual, but as a whole, tend to have higher levels of LPS, higher levels of negative gram bacteria. These are bacteria which reside in a normal, healthy gut, but there could be various levels of that. So the more LPS we produce, the more type of this bacteria we've got, the higher the systemic inflammation is going to be. LPS initially is going to start to degrade the gut lining, and then we're going to get LPS that's going to pass through the gut lining into the blood, and then it's going to translocate. And so when it does translocate, it tends to have an affinity for various places. And so that would be places like where there's a lot of cartilage, okay? And then also places like the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And so symptoms like joint pain, like stiff neck, finger pain, these really common with LPS overload, but then also pelvic pain or endometriosis type, you know, menstrual cycle pain. That's very common with LPS overload as well. And what we know as well with the LPS is it can actually trigger tissue growth. Yeah. And so in a case of endo with the endometrium-like tissue, LPS itself could actually be a trigger for the growth of that. Now, that's one thing that's happening, but if we take a step back and say, well, this is potentially exacerbated by negative gram bacteria, what else does negative gram bacteria do? Well, negative gram bacteria is one sort of family, one type of one classification, I guess, of bacteria, many of which make up SIBO. Okay, so SIBO can be made up of negative or positive gram bacteria. So if we use an example here, let's say Klebsiella or E. coli, these are two types of negative gram bacteria. These are very common with SIBO, okay? And so when we have this overgrowth of SIBO, there's a couple of things that, so you know, I should take a step back. What we know again in studies is that women with endometriosis have a higher chance of having SIBO. And when they have both, when they've treated the SIBO, their endo pain has actually improved as well. So there's a correlation there. Is that because of the LPS? Is it because of something else? We don't know. Now, there's also something called estrobolem. Basically, in really simple terms, this has to do with bacteria regulating estrogen. And so if you've got an overgrowth of this type of bacteria in the small intestine, it's actually causing this sort of unconjugating, this uncoupling of estrogen. And so now you're recirculating estrogen. One thing we've known for a long time is there's something to do with estrogen when it comes to endometriosis. Is that too high systemic estrogen? Not necessarily, but estrogen's having more of a impact at a tissue level, right? So now we've got these multiple pathways that actually an overgrowth of bacteria in the gut could be leading to, exacerbating, potentially even causing endometriosis. Coupled with that, we've got new studies now that show women with endometriosis have a much higher likelihood of having a nickel sensitivity. And so this is now a question I would ask all of my clients, especially anyone with period pain. How do you respond to nickel? If you wear cheap earrings or a cheap necklace or something, do you get skin irritation? Mm-hmm. And the percentage, the correlation of people with period pain and endometriosis who have that is astronomical. And so in that instance, what's going on there? Well, there's nickel in our food, there's nickel in cans, there's nickel in our cookingware. Right. And so if these people are exposed to nickel constantly, they're cooking on a stainless steel pan, which has nickel in it, they're getting coffees out of a stainless steel coffee machine, which has nickel in it, that could be causing this low-grade chronic gut inflammation, essentially low-grade gut permeability.
Yeah.
And so how could that be affecting inflammation, period pain? So there's a lot going on, and it's not that it's just going to be one thing for each individual, but there's so many avenues for us to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see it in blood work, right? Like I've got a client who spoke, a new client I started with yesterday,
mm-hmm.
who's got endo. I just got a bloods back today, so it's in the forefront of my mind. But all these things suggesting LPS popped up. So we can see this in blood work in a market called GGT.
Mm-hmm.
If we see GGT out of sort of range, I would say I work with 13 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
If we see it out of that, that is suggestive that there's a glutathione issue,
yeah.
and LPS depletes glutathione.
Yeah.
So we can start to get some clues. Okay, if that wasn't an issue, well, maybe we would see white blood cells depressed. And if we see that, that's telling us there's probably more gut permeability. So to just say, well, I've got this condition, what caused it? That's the wrong question. You know, the question is, I've got these symptoms, I've got this condition, and these are my bloods, these are my symptoms. You know, what's causing it? You know what I mean?
100%. And am I correct in saying that I think I saw a study that kind of showed the impact of environmental toxins and chemicals on endometriosis as well? So, you know, whether we know about them, sort of like BPA, household chemicals and things like that. Is that true from what you've seen?
Yeah, I can't recall the exact study. I do vaguely remember seeing it. And we've had studies for a long time that suggests that exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals and compounds can actually affect not just the individual, but mm-hmm. their offspring, and even two generations down as well. It could affect epigenetics, and which would affect the way you deal with things like estrogen. So, you know, we've known that for a long time, but yeah, like you said, there's other studies showing a link there as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to, sometimes it's very hard when you're working with clients, but you're thinking what's done, what's caused what for what person, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, if you're talking about plastics and chemicals and endocrine disrupting compounds, it's like, yeah, but we're all exposed to that.
Yeah.
Was it that for that person? Was it? So, you know, I guess like our job is sort of to work out, well, what are the opportunities here? Okay, this person's dousing themselves in chemicals.
Yeah.
That's an opportunity for us to change.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that was what the issue was with that person? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's X number of variables we can totally, you know, start to impact and change.
And I think one thing else as well that I wanted to touch on is, when we have not just endometriosis, obviously we have seen that is kind of like, estrogen does have a role in endometriosis, but also estrogen in just people without endometriosis. So when we see kind of things like heavy periods and really bad PMS and stuff,
yeah,
estrogen's kind of like metabolized and cleared in the gut, right? So our gut health does actually directly correlate to our hormones as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was like that link I was talking about before with an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've got more or less of certain types of bacteria, we'll produce more or less of that enzyme, which will mean whether, you know, we might be uncoupling more and recirculating more,
mm-hmm.
or maybe we're not recirculating enough. And so that will lead to imbalances. And then, you know, not only is that sort of one factor, but then we need to eliminate, and we need to actually clear this stuff out of our system. And a way we do that is we conjugate it with like bile and we sort of we excrete it out. And so if someone's got bile issues, that's going to cause issues there. So, you know, something I see, I generally work more with female clients, but when I do work with male clients who, you know, a common sort of health issue that I see is like breast tissue development, so gynecomastia. And yeah, and almost always when I have clients like that, I'll see there's a bilirubin issue, almost always. And what's bilirubin doing? Well, it's affecting our bile production. It is impacted by SIBO, again, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or fungal overgrowth will cause issues with bile and bilirubin. But if we've got issues here with bile, not only is bile needed for it's an antimicrobial. It's actually helping control levels of bacteria, but it's also needed for toxin or hormone elimination. And so that itself could be affecting hormone regulation as well. Mm-hmm. So it's really like we need to look at this stuff, you know, like we can't, it does my head in when I get clients and their bilirubin's like, you know, through the roof, super high. And I'll be like, what did the doctor say? And they'll be like, oh, a doctor said I've got high bilirubin, therefore I've got Gilbert syndrome. Gilbert syndrome is basically a genetic issue which causes high bilirubin, yeah? And I'll be like, okay, how did they diagnose that? And they're like, oh, off my high bilirubin. that's not a diagnosis. Like, you can't just say, well, you've got a dysfunction here in the blood valley, therefore I'm just going to say you've got a condition and not going to do anything about it. You still got gyno. Like, I've got guys who come to me who said, well, doctors said I've got Gilbert's, don't need to do anything, but I've got sensitive nipples. Yeah. It's like, okay, well, should we do something about that? You know what I mean?
Honestly, like, I think this is why, like, I just, my mind is literally blown every day because there's just so much to learn and so much to like, what we just spoke about, obviously, with PMS, gut health, estrogen, all this stuff. Like, it's kind of like there's quite a lot of components. It's not really just this causes this. This is this.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, okay, well, there's a few different factors going on. We need to look at a range of things to actually get a full picture and understanding of it. And I think that's why it's so important to actually start learning about it. Like, you know, I'm by no means an expert at all, but I learn something new literally every single week to do with the gut and all this kind of stuff because there's so much to learn. But being aware of it is also, I think, so important because we are seeing more and more people with like chronic conditions, right? Like gut health, menstrual health, all this kind of stuff is just so big now. And when you mentioned with the client that got the diagnosis from the bilirubin, it reminded me of someone I spoke to last week and she told me she had PCOS. And I kind of just, whenever I get a client with PCOS, I just ask them how they're diagnosed just to confirm. She goes, oh, I had an ultrasound and they told me I had PCOS. I was like, oh, did you get any bloods done? She's like, no. I was like, oh, okay. You know, and it's kind of like, are we misdiagnosing people with something? And then they're carrying that thinking, oh, I can't lose weight because I've got PCOS. When some people probably don't actually have it. Like, it's mind-blowing. Or it's like when they're in their teenage years and we know that PCOS can be temporary in teenage years, right? When you're a teenager because of your menstrual cycle is still maturing, your hormones are still kind of balancing, ovulation, all this kind of stuff. And they're carrying that label with them for the next 10 years, going, oh, well, I struggle to lose weight because I've got PCOS, I struggle with this, when they actually might not even have it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's spot on. Again, you know, to give you an example like the one you just gave, I had a client today send me their bloods who has been diagnosed with PCOS, exact same situation, diagnosed off an ultrasound. Mm-hmm. These are the first bloods she's had, literally the first blood she's had done. And glucose levels are fine, androgen levels are fine, insulin levels are fine. There's nothing to me that's suggesting this is really PCOS. She doesn't have any of these hyperandrogenic symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so it is purely based on having a scan and seeing some cysts, which I understand the logical leap there. It's like, well, this is polycystic ovary syndrome. Okay, if they've got cysts, they have PCOS. But it's a bad naming issue. It's a marketing issue. You know what I mean? It's not like, well, that doesn't mean that's actually how this you know syndrome is diagnosed. And doctors need to know that. You know, doctors need to stop giving out these labels to everyone because someone does wear that, like you said, and they do think this is a death sentence. And they think there's nothing I can ever do to reverse this. Mm-hmm. And I've got this problem with me. It's like, you probably don't even have a problem with you. And if you do, we can do a lot to fix it.
Exactly. And I think that's the worrying thing. It's like, how many people are misdiagnosed? Or then we get the other end of the spectrum with, I say this all the time, like, endometriosis, and then that kind of goes undiagnosed for so long. It's like you kind of like have this like massive spectrum. Like, it's just insane. And I just every time I'm just like, wow, like, is this really really going on? But just to clarify, you know, you can have PCOS without having polycystic ovaries, and you can have polycystic ovaries without having PCOS. So for those that may suspect, the best way to go about it is obviously blood work as well, because blood work is the best way to look at how our bodies are functioning internally, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, do a scan. We're not saying don't do an ultrasound, but you need to do that in combination with symptoms, in combination with blood work.
Yeah.
One thing by itself, even blood work by itself isn't enough, right? We need to look at the whole picture.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And one thing I know we don't have too much time left, but one thing I wanted to, one funny thing I wanted to go over is I followed Jake for a couple of years now. And I remember one of the first posts, I you know, loved all Jake's stuff. And Jake posted this Instagram post one time. And I'm talking like, this was like a year and a half. It was a long time ago. And I want to read it out to you. So Jake had posted something that said, "Unpopular truth, labeling food as good or bad as a coach is not negligence." I can never say the word. Negligence. "Telling someone to eat food that will screw with their microbiome, damage their gut lining, inflame their body, weaken their immune system, and fast track chronic disease, that's negligence." And I actually disagreed with this post purely because of my own bias towards my own perception, basically. And I'd sort of commented, and I remember sort of saying, like, this is wrong. We shouldn't be labeling foods as good and bad. And I had this mentality for so long. I've spoken about this before, but I've had a lot of different things with my own relationship with food. And I ended up getting to a point where all I thought mattered was calories. So I went from one end of being not letting people touch my food because I didn't want anything bad in there to almost not caring what I was eating as long as it fit my calories. And I was like, oh, no foods are good and bad. And now that I've kind of obviously, you know, gone on through life and learnt more and everything like this, I've kind of realized, I'm like, okay, you know, we is that damaging? Because there's such a big thing now about, oh, we can't label foods as good and bad. But for me, I was doing that, but I wasn't caring about what I was eating. So are we kind of giving people a false impression that they can eat whatever the hell they want while sort of, you know, obviously most people want fat loss, but we have to think about health as well. And yeah, like I said, I disagreed with it at the time. And looking back now, I remember saying to Jake when I started mentoring with him, I was like, remember that post I held disagreed with? How funny, like, I'm, you know, and now I agree with you, because we can't sort of baby everyone saying, you know, oh, don't worry, like, nothing's bad. Because for some people, like you said in the post, there are foods that are driving us in, or the whole population, into more chronic health issues, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think there's so many good things you said there. And, you know, as a starting point, everything we do, every way we respond to anything is just like an emotional response. It's off something that we're correlating that to some other emotional experience we've had or some other trigger or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I was partly playing off that in that post. You know, I understand there's emotive words that are good, bad. You know, these are emotional words. I get that. And so partly, I guess what I was trying to get at there is, you know, I think if we look at the health industry, probably the biggest danger to people's health is probably the health industry. Mm-hmm. The information that's being perpetuated, I think that is doing incredibly more damage than anything else is, because it's coming from, you know, supposed experts, and they are suggesting people do things that are harmful for their health. Now, is good and bad a good label for food? Probably not, but realistic and that's probably, you know, that's what elicited that emotional response in you. Mm-hmm. But realistically, either foods are going to be harmful or at least have a harmful impact on someone. Either foods are going to be beneficial. And that's what we're seeing, is we've distilled it down into health. And I mean, I don't even know why we call it health and fitness, really. It's fitness, it's fat loss. That's kind of all it is, right? Yeah. And so in this sort of world, we've distilled it down to, yeah, calories, and then the new buzz terminology is more or less nutritious. But I've got an issue with that. It's not more or less nutritious. I can't go eat arsenic and say that's just less nutritious for me. Like, if something's actually a physiological poison to my body, that's not just less nutritious. That's causing damage. Yeah. And it's like we've kind of just skirted around that and like, well, we're not going to touch on that. We're just going to say it's not as good for fat loss. It's like, well, we're actually causing damage when we do this. Now, there's obviously always nuance, and, you know, we need to understand who we're talking to. And, you know, you've sort of explained that you came out of a background where, you know, maybe there was unhealthy relationships with food. And so for those people, if someone's coming from a disordered eating background, are using those labels going to be beneficial? No. But we also need to understand that it's all tied together. And does that therefore mean saying, eat these foods that are actually worsening your anxiety is a helpful message? Like, that's not helpful either. So there's just so much in that. But I absolutely love that you, not just that you changed your opinion, because, you know, obviously it's nice to hear people say they agree with me, and, you know, that's sort of all well and good as well. But I love that even when you didn't agree with me, you know, I remember seeing your name pop up on like other posts, and I was like, oh, you know, Sophie's cool. Like, you know, every time I talk about female health, like your name would pop up and you'd have conversations with other people and stuff. I was like, oh, this is cool. And then when I saw that pop up, I was like, oh, I probably lost Sophie as a follower. Like, you know, that's it. She's gone. And you did it. Like, you kept engaging and you know, you were able to hold that space and say, well, this is something at this point in time I disagree with. And whether or not you came around to it, you're still able to hold it and say, well, there's still value in some of this other stuff that he's saying. And so I think even though that's not really about health, I think that is not a personality aspect, but that's something that we just need more of. You know, there's so much division in the health and fitness world, in social media, and just the entire world at the moment. It's like, well, we can hold space with someone who says something that actually that bit we don't agree with, but some other bits we do, and they've got value to add, and there's something they can teach us. And I think that's probably the most important bit of what you've, like, what we sort of brought up all of in all of this bit, yeah, is.
I wanted, yeah, to touch on that, actually. That's what I was about to say. I was like, you know, we live in a world now where if someone doesn't like something, they'll hate the person, they'll hate everything they say, they'll kind of,
yeah,
we kind of cancel them out. I looked at that, yeah, post. I disagreed with it at the time, but it didn't make me disagree with everything else because I absolutely loved everything else. I just, you know, cool. I put my opinion on the post, whatever. I look back and I'm cringe at it, but, you know, it's one of those things. And I moved on from it and I kept following everything else. Like, I think that's what, like what you said, we don't, just because you don't agree with something, like, just, you know, if there's someone you follow who, I don't know, promotes keto and you think that keto is a bunch of whatever, you know, you don't need to disagree with everything they say. We do still have a place for people that can still bring value, as you said, but we don't need to cancel them out completely. Like, we all have our opinions, yeah, and we all have, you know, things that we believe in, but we do live in a culture now where it's kind of like, if you don't like one thing that someone said, it kind of, your initial or our initial thought is just, well, get rid of them. Like, no, we don't like you, blah, blah, yeah, blah. I think that's definitely one of the most important things. But yeah, really love that conversation. Like you said, I think, you know, I came from a background of unhealthy relationship with food. So not labeling food as, not being scared of, you know, unhealthy foods, and put that in quotation marks, yeah, because, you know, we all know what kind of foods I'm referring to. Learning that those foods aren't going to kill me at the time was really, yes, important for my relationship with food. But as I've, yeah, gone over that, I need to start prioritizing, because I got to a point where I wasn't prioritizing good food. I was like, well, nothing's good and bad. I can, yeah, eat whatever I want. So now it's kind of about finding, you know, we all are in different journeys. So for some people, like I said, labeling good and food isn't going to be isn't going to be good for them, like you mentioned. But we do have to come to a point where we do need to understand that there are some foods, or for us, that aren't going to be as beneficial. And once you come over that kind of relationship with food barrier, we can sort of look at, okay, which foods are actually going to be better for me? I'm going to start prioritizing them. Doesn't mean you have to think everything's bad for you. It's just that, okay, we want to make our bodies feel as good as they can and everything like this. And I think that's a really important point to make as well. Yes, let's still got a little bit of time. So I have a couple of questions, nothing too hectic. There was a couple of questions from the followers just wanting your opinion on. The first one was, is finger prick blood work a good option?
So it depends a little bit on what you're, whenever the question's about testing, it depends on why. Yeah, what's the context to the testing? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so many different tests that people can do. There's so many different microbiome tests, there's, you know, live blood tests, there's you know, hair mineral analysis tests, different stool testing. There's so many different options out there. Mm-hmm. Now, some of these in the right hands can give you more information. Okay, you know, if we talk about SIBO testing, in the right hands, I can give you more information. In the wrong hands, it gives you useless information. And too often, I'll get people come to me and they'll have done 8 different tests and they'll show me, you know, literally $4,000 worth of testing. And then the conclusion that they were given based on that testing isn't even what the testing is showing. You know, they show me a SIBO test and they say, well, I got diagnosed as having positive SIBO. I'm like, I don't even know how you came to that conclusion, because it doesn't show that. So I like going to the bare basics, right? I think a standard blood test, mm-hmm, we can't, how do we go wrong there? That's telling us literally at this point in time exactly what's going on in your body. We can test hormones. We can get nutrient, sort of not specific nutrients, but we can get global nutrient, information from that. So for me, it's like, yeah, you know, can, finger prick testing give us information? Can, even doing like a food sensitivity test with blood pricks as well, can that give us information? It can. But I would say in 99.9% of cases, you don't need that.
Yeah.
In 99.9% of cases, start with bloods, normal bloods, okay? That's going to give you far, far, far more information. Then get someone who can assess sort of thyroid symptoms and combine those two. So I don't know if that's sort of answered.
No, that's really helpful. Yeah, I completely, yeah. Obviously from working with yourself, we know that blood work or standard blood work is one of the best ways, not the only way, but one of the best ways to kind of look at the body internally as well.
And it's cheap, it's affordable, it's accessible. You know, you can normally just go to your doctor and do it. If your doctor won't do it, you can normally pay like $150 and get it done with pathology.
Yeah.
So for the amount of information it gives you, it's just, it's definitely the best starting point by a mile.
Super helpful. Second one kind of relates to what we were speaking about before with blood work. Why are bloods always normal? We often say kind of, just because your bloods are normal doesn't mean they are. So this person's saying, well, just why are they put as normal, but then actually not normal? Hope that question makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what is normal? One in two people have a chronic health condition. What is it, 40% of people overweight or obese? So if that's what we're dictating is normal, then your bloods probably are normal. Your bloods are going to be about, if we're saying these are normal bloods, that means they're as normal as that person who's got a chronic health condition and is overweight, right? So that's sort of the one problem, is that normal is no longer healthy, okay? So we're not saying these are healthy. We're saying this is what we expect to see in the general population, okay? So that's one issue. The second issue is, blood markers, there's different labs, and different labs can actually dictate their own ranges, and there's different ways they do that. Generally, what they're going to do is they're just going to get to collate all the data they have, okay, and then they're just going to plot it out on a graph, and they're just going to create a bell curve based on all the test results they've got. And again, who's likely to get blood tests done with a lab? It's going to be people who are sick, probably people who are overweight, people who are old, people who have some kind of health condition, okay? So now we've plotted that, and it's not like we even exclude those people. What we'll do is, and I say we, I'm certainly not part of this, but what the labs will do is they'll get someone who's got a heart condition, and they'll say, well, you've got a heart condition, therefore you've got high cholesterol. We won't use your cholesterol marker as sort of the body of data in this test. But just because you've got a heart condition doesn't mean you've got any other health issues. So we're going to use your white blood cells, and we'll use your red blood cells, and we'll still use all of that. Or you've got diabetes, we won't use your glucose, but we'll use your cholesterol.
Yeah.
Right? So, because people often argue, well, there's exclusion criteria and whatnot. Well, not really. Like, we're still using people who are sick for the other markers. And we've just discussed that the whole body works together. So why would I expect someone's neutrophils to be good and someone who's got four different health conditions, right? So that's one issue with it. Other issues, like there's labs I know of where there's one lab, this is how they got their data. They tested everyone in the office, and then they plotted that, and they said, okay, these are our values now.
Oh, my God.
It's like, does this have any – dead set. It's like, does this have any correlation to any scientific literature, to any information around longevity or actual optimal health? Not at all. Mm-hmm. So they're the primary issues, okay? So we're just comparing to these arbitrary numbers that have nothing to do with health, okay? The second issue is, for someone listening to this, go and check your blood test, and I can almost guarantee you that you're probably going to have at least one marker which is outside of those values. Mm-hmm. This is not even the optimal values. These are just these insane arbitrary values.
Mm-hmm.
I had one client last week that had 8 tests that were outside those optimal values, their conventional values, and they were still told that their bloods were perfect.
Wow.
Okay, so even if you're falling outside of these arbitrary, insanely broad windows, you're still going to be told your bloods are normal most of the time. I'm sure there's good doctors out there. I just haven't seen that many.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, these these numbers, these test results mean nothing. So I'm a huge advocate of getting blood work done, but here's what I'd say. Go get your bloods done, ask for a copy, and I can't tell you to disregard what your doctor's telling you, but I would say you're probably not going to get overly much helpful information from that, okay? And then go find someone who, and maybe it is your doctor, maybe your doctor is trained in how to assess against optimal values, but unfortunately it's not something which is taught you know, commonly. They would have to seek that out themselves. And there's actually doctors I mentor on that as well, in doing the same stuff that you do with me, Soph, and you know, they've made it very clear that that's not stuff that they learned, right? Like they're not looking for how, you know, bloods correlate together or functional values, optimal ranges, any of that. Mm-hmm. So get your blood tests and then go find someone who does do that. Mm-hmm. And that's not a job, right? So in that, I mean, it's not saying that you need to go to a naturopath or you need to go to a functional doctor, you need to go to a nutrition coach or whatever, right? It depends on the person. There's going to be some GPs who can do that, and there's going to be some functional doctors who do that, and some naturopaths who do that, and some naturopaths who don't do that. And so what's more important here is that the individual you're going to, you trust, you know how to interpret these test results and actually give you, you know, this is what you know, the functional values are, this is what it means if you're outside those functional values, as opposed to, I think it all looks normal, nothing was really highlighted, so I guess it's fine.
Yeah, for sure, I totally agree. And I think one thing, I think it was probably you who taught me, it's kind of like your blood results are pretty much just normal against the whole population. And
yeah,
we know that, I think I read a stat, I'm not, don't quote me on this, but it was like 87% of people actually aren't metabolically healthy. So you're...
I think it was 88% even. Yeah. I think there's only 12% of people who are, and this was done in America, but we can probably draw the conclusions probably the same over here.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Our bloods are kind of just paired against them, really, like the population. So it kind of, that's, in a nutshell, kind of why your bloods can be normal, but not actually normal. Last one, kind of just a personal one for you. What are some things that you prioritize just for optimal health? I know this is going to look different for everyone, but maybe just a few of your main ones, I guess, that more people should be incorporating into their own life to really optimize their health.
That's a good question, and it's important for us as coaches and health advocates to be sort of walking the walk as well. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. I would say it's harder and harder, you know, especially with sort of like the current climate and, you know, the more and more people who are unhealthy, the more and more demand there is sort of on, you know, practitioners who are working with these people. So it can be hard to kind of set these boundaries and have, you know, space and time for yourself as well. But I'd say key things that I prioritize for my own health, I try to get outdoors every day and try to get some significant sun exposure every day. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, ideally I try to get a good hour in the sun every single day. I try to get sun exposure or light exposure first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. That's sort of really important as far as sort of like consolidating your circadian rhythm, keeping sort of a like sleep-wake cycle pattern, even just for mental health, we know that's important. So that's something that I certainly prioritize. Movement. I mean, look, the basics. I don't think I'm going to wow you with anything sort of super exciting here, but, you know, daily movement. Yeah. I set myself a step target, you know, stuff that we're doing with our clients, you know, same kind of stuff that we should be doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm walking, I try to walk barefoot. I try to walk in places where I can connect to the earth. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's grass or dirt or whatever, you know, ideally sand and water, but obviously, but here in Sydney at the moment, I'm limited to where I can go and I can't access any water. But, you know, I try to get barefoot, ground every day, in the sun, move, lift heavy things. One approach I've taken with my own clients is I used to do nutrition coaching in isolation. Mm-hmm. And over the last year or so, I've stopped offering that, and I only do it as part of a complete coaching package, but I do workout training programming with people and I do the lifestyle stuff as well, because movement is so important and people aren't moving well, I would say.
Yeah.
And you know, there's, you know, we don't know how to exercise well. You know, we think exercise means let's just do any form of exercise and let me just go kill myself in a park and do a million burpees and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And so I would say lifting heavy. I think everyone should be lifting heavy. Is that just my bias? Possibly. But I certainly think that from an anti-aging standpoint, a longevity standpoint, from even just like daily quality of life, the amount of women I work with who are like, man, I didn't realize how hard it was to carry groceries home. Like I thought that was just what everyone was experiencing. And now that I'm stronger, it's like, wow, I don't need someone to carry my stuff for me. And I can, you know, like that kind of just basic, like, man, I was in the amount of people who are like, I just thought neck pain was normal. And then I started deadlifting, and now I realize I don't need to be in chronic pain all the time, you know? So lifting heavy, I think that's a fundamental one. And then I guess, I mean, obviously, you know, there's heaps of stuff I could say about diet, but I probably won't jump into that. But I think community or purpose or whatever you want to call it, whatever words you want to put to it, I think having some degree of connection to something else, I think that's really fundamental. That's something that, you know, it's harder and harder to do with, you know, the current climate, and it's hard to be physically connected to people, but to feel like you're not alone, to feel like you're not kind of, you know, just fighting against everyone else and, you know, off doing your own mission, but to actually know that there's people who are doing similar good work, you know, so people like yourself, Soph, I can look at these people and say, you know what, there's actually a whole bunch of coaches who want to transform the health industry and actually want to, you know, transform people's health and take people to the next level. And, you know, feeling connected in that, or feeling, you know, secure in what your own purpose is in the world, and being part of, you know, other people achieving that, I think that is really underrated. And you probably see this with clients. I know I certainly do, where there's some clients who they might be addressing gut health and they might be addressing diet and they might be doing the movement and exercise and whatnot, but something is not working. And, you know, they're kind of just, they might get this much better, this little bit better, but there's still energy is still low, or symptoms are still there, or, you know, there's something that's still holding them back. And I do think a lot of the time, whether it's, we want to call it mindset or purpose or whatever we call it, I do think that that is something which will impact people's health. And, you know, if you are struggling to get out of bed and thinking to yourself, I don't even have any purpose today, let alone in my life, like, how do you think that organism, that human is going to function in society? Like, you're probably not going to be functioning all that well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something which, you know, how do you have that conversation with clients? I don't know. Like, do you feel like you've got a purpose? I don't know. But I think actually being in tune with that matters as well.
For sure. I think that's really underrated, and it's something that I've sort of been learning about over the last, I'd say, 6 months specifically. But yeah, it's so awesome just to hear kind of, and like you said, it is the foundations, and it's probably nothing mind-blowing, but people kind of jump to the, they're like, oh, how many days a week should I work out, or, you know, which diet should I do? It's kind of like, most people aren't actually, as much as, yeah, it's probably basic, most people probably aren't actually doing the basics. So it's just reinforcing those actual, you know, and sunlight, daily, getting in nature, like movement, like, as much as people kind of go, oh, well, you know, I just need to drop my calories, I just need to stick to my calories, it's kind of like, well, how about the other aspects of health as well that we're probably not prioritizing?
Yeah.
So it's just really awesome to hear kind of things that you prioritize as well. Awesome. That was incredible. Jake, obviously there's a few different services you have. I'm obviously mentoring with you at the moment. Honestly, one of the best things I've done. I'm not just saying that because I'm on a podcast, but honestly, like, the stuff you learn is just incredible. So obviously, do you still have any spots for mentoring coaches?
I do. So it's something that I really enjoy. And so I keep kind of telling myself, okay, I'm going to cap here. And then I'm like, oh, but I really enjoyed this. And so maybe I'll just take another one. So currently I haven't capped my mentoring clients. So yeah, if that's something people are interested in, absolutely shoot me a message. I've got some info on my social media about that. But it's just something that, you know, I do love being connected with people like yourself and other coaches who are saying, you know what, the industry kind of has probably dropped the ball a little bit here, and that's not what we're interested in. We are interested in actually being leaders in this movement and being leaders in the health and fitness world, and supporting each other. And, you know, it's, you don't want to do this stuff alone. You know, if your coach is trying to do this stuff alone, whether you do mentor with me or with someone else, I can't encourage you enough to actually connect with other people who are doing the work, because A, you're just going to become so much better, so much quicker if you can actually bounce off other people. But B, you know, to go back to that sense of purpose, it's just going to help give you longevity in this movement, you know. Otherwise you're probably gonna burn out.
100% for sure. And the amount you just learn every day is just incredible, and it's hands-on experience. It's not like, here's a worksheet to fill in. It's like, you know, fully, like, actual practical stuff, which is something I think a lot of coaches enjoy. It's a way that people enjoy learning, and it's a good way to enjoy learning. So if you are a coach, obviously you can contact Jake if you'd like to learn more about all of the stuff. It's incredible. And for those who don't follow you on Instagram, where can we find you? It's coach_Jake Dollarshow.
Yep, that's exactly right. So Doleschal, Doleschal. So that's currently the only place I'm on. I don't use Facebook. I don't use anything else. I am almost about to launch a website. It's almost going live just because, because I have had a lot of people being like, I can't find you on Instagram anymore. What's going on? Or your posts have disappeared or whatever else. So obviously there is some interesting stuff going on in the social media world. So my website will be live hopefully in the next month or so for people to find me there too.
Incredible. And one other thing I saw is, were you launching a course over the next few months or year?
I will be, yeah. So actually with one of my mentors, so Dave O'Brien, if people don't follow him, they certainly should. So we are doing a course on basically some of the stuff we've talked about today for coaches, largely for coaches. Anyone can use it, can do it. But a lot of these issues that people just – coaches maybe don't feel equipped to deal with. So it'll be stuff like SIBO, all the different gut dysfunctions. So we're going to be talking about SIBO, going to be talking about H. pylori, going to be talking about candida and yeast, and SIFO, parasites, leaky gut, and then also the combination of those. You know, what do you do if you don't just have a client who's got one, but what do you do if you've got a client who's got all of these or two of these or three of these? And so I'm really excited for that. It's something that I've not sort of seen anywhere else. You know, I have seen some practitioners talk about maybe one of these things in isolation, and it's not normally in the context of fitness as well. So, you know, we are going to be talking about, well, not just here's what you do from a supplement standpoint, here's what you do from a diet standpoint, here's what you do from an exercise standpoint, here's how you actually achieve body composition with these people as well. So that will be launching in the later part of this year. So we've almost finished the content. We have to film. We're stuck in different states with lockdown, so it's a little bit difficult at the moment.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, that'll be live.
That's going to be insane. Same. And I think I've always said, I'm like, Jake needs to do a course. Like in my head, I'm like, come on, like, Jake surely has to have a course at some time. So it's awesome that you're doing that. But Jake often, like, even if you're not a coach, Jake often gives his time to do Q&As on Instagram. Just the post, you can learn, even if you're not a coach, you can learn so much from his Instagram. So if you don't already, make sure you go and chuck him a follow. Jake, thank you so much for joining me today. I think this podcast was just incredible. It was so, so awesome to have you on.
Absolute pleasure, mate. Love talking about this stuff. Love what you're doing. Love working with you, Soph. So thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely love working with you too. Catch you soon.